Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC with us now, with the courage to look at himself in the mirror and the audacity to look at major news organizations, is Nate Silver, the founder and editor-in-chief of ESPN's data journalism site, 538. Nate is publishing a series of articles that will, for the most part, analyze how conventional horse race journalism assessed the election, but also what the pollsters got right and wrong and poll aggregation analytics sites like his own. The series is called The Real Story of 2016. Hi, Nate. Welcome back to WNYC. Thanks for doing this.
Hey, thank you, Brian.
First, for openness sake, listeners may be hearing this and thinking to themselves, 538 got the election wrong, too, with their projections. So what gives you the high ground to assess other media outlets?
Well, for one thing, the way we look at the world is in terms of probability and uncertainty. And we spent a lot of time throughout the election saying that we thought people thought Clinton had it in the bag when they shouldn't have thought that. When the data told a more ambiguous story, we have a forecast model that had Trump with about a 30% chance. That's a not unlikely event. That's Dustin Pedroia or David Ortiz or Derek Jeter getting a base hit or something like that. But we think there needs to be more statistical literacy, and we think that starts with people distinguishing between a 30% chance, say, for example, and a 1% chance where some other forecasts had the race. I mean, those are really different forecasts, and those affected the way we cover the campaign in terms of taking Trump's chances seriously. And I think this is a website that I think we had all types of problems in the Republican primary. 2015, we thought Trump, I mean, this can't really be happening, can it? But we thought people made the opposite mistake in the general election, the same mistake, really, underrating his chances when the polls showed actually a race that was very competitive in the Electoral College.
Yeah, and you gave Trump, by the end of the campaign, and really through the campaign, a better chance of winning the election than most media polls, though you still wound up on Election Day with Clinton having about a 70% chance of winning, right?
Yeah, look, I think Clinton, it's not a matter of opinion, really. I mean, Clinton was favored based on the polls, but the point is that people treat it as though this was Reagan versus Mondale when it was maybe, Bush versus Gore or something, a close election. I mean, she was ahead in most polls, but people were looking at polls that showed her 2 or 3 points ahead in a bunch of swing states. On average, you go back to 1968, polls missed by an average of 2 or 3 points. So all that meant is that if you had an average-sized polling error, and it was in Trump's favor instead of Clinton's favor, then you potentially had Trump winning the Electoral College. And why people didn't see that, because to us it seemed like, it was a little bit kind of an emperor has no clothes moment where it's like, this is a close election, and people weren't processing that somehow. In 2012, we kind of had the opposite problem where people were insistent that it was a toss-up between President Obama and Mitt Romney when Obama's position in the Electoral College was actually a lot stronger than Clinton, and we can talk about why that was. But I don't know. To me, it was a case where the conventional wisdom got really far out ahead of itself and kind of ignored evidence from polling, from demographics, from economics, from other things that suggested that Trump had a real credible shot at winning on November 8th.
People are starting to call in, so let me give out the number for everybody else if you want to talk to Nate Silver, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. To your point, there was a moment just after the Billy Bush Access Hollywood tape came out, which was early October, so it was pretty close to the election, just a month in advance, where a lot of the media was saying, oh, now it's really collapsing for Trump. This could wind up being a landslide win. And was that based on the fact that the polls were really volatile and people were coming and going from the Trump campaign and the Clinton campaign? And if the election was held on October 9th, 2 days after that tape came out, it really would have been a landslide? Or was that the news media and the analysts on television really getting ahead of the numbers?
I think people should have been careful about the fact that there was still a long ways to go in the campaign and that there were a lot of undecided voters. So there were definitely moments when you had Clinton, for example, at 45% of the vote and Trump at 39% of the vote. That's about where it was after the Access Hollywood tape. You know, 39% is really bad for a major party candidate, but 45% is also a long way from having clinched much of anything. And when Clinton had her own problems in the news cycle later in the race, and Trump was able to come back enough to win the Electoral College. But look, you know, our contention is that especially the national polling actually did a fairly good job. So we tend to take the polling relatively at face value when it says that if you had held an election in early October, Clinton might have won the popular vote by 6 points. She wound up winning the popular vote by 2 points, which is not that radically different as far as the popular vote goes. But, of course, that led 4 or 5 or 6 states, which were very close, to swing from Clinton to Trump. But yeah, look, polls and people respond to events in the news cycle. And I think part of the problem was that people were looking after the debates, which went pretty well for Clinton. She was up 5 or 6 or 7 points. Then you had Comey letter, you had WikiLeaks, you had maybe people coming back to Trump because of partisanship. I mean, it's, you know, it's a partisan country. It tends to be pretty 50-50. And so the race tightened a lot in the final 10 days, going from a 6-point Clinton lead to a 3-point Clinton lead in national polls. According to our model, she was actually vulnerable in the Electoral College when the lead got to 2 or 3 or 4 points, and lost a number of states narrowly on election day. So, yeah, part of this is that people kind of baked in the story in mid-October, and the story changed in late October, because a 6-point lead, that would have required a massive, unprecedented polling error. A 3-point lead isn't safe at all, the way her vote was was not concentrated in the swing states.
And she did win the popular vote by 2 points, as you said. So would it be accurate to say the national polls got it right, but many state polls got it wrong?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's more or less right. I mean, the state polls did fine in a number of states like Colorado and Florida. Not Florida so much, but Colorado, Virginia, Nevada, states like that. Those were states where Clinton met her polls, actually exceeded them a little bit in Nevada. But there were the polls weren't great in the Midwest. By the way, one thing, too, is that we don't have that many great state polls anymore, you know. So it's not like there were dozens of polls from Wisconsin and Pennsylvania showing Clinton with big leads. You might have 1 or 2 high-quality polls in those states, and they did show her ahead. But you also had polls of Iowa, for example, the Des Moines Register poll, which is a great poll there, showing her down 7 points. She wound up losing Iowa by almost 9 or 10 points, and so that could have been a warning sign, potentially. You saw, you know, problems for her in Ohio, a state that traditionally is a bellwether state. And yes, she could win without Ohio, but it was a sign that you know, she wasn't running as strongly as President Obama, who, of course, won Ohio twice. And the kind of combination of the white working class vote, or for being more precise, white voters without college degrees, because education was the main predictor, plus a little bit of a decline in African-American turnout, not low, but compared to the historic highs for the first African-American president, that declined a little bit. And that meant all of a sudden, instead of having an Electoral College advantage, Clinton had a disadvantage instead. Because these big Midwestern states that are close and have a lot of electoral votes, the Democrats relied historically on a big African-American turnout, plus enough white union workers, working class voters turning out. There are not a lot of Hispanics in those states. There are not a lot of college-educated whites in those states. And if that part of the coalition falls apart, then all of a sudden she lost the Electoral College despite winning the popular vote by a pretty big margin.
Nate Silver from 538 with us with his postmortem of the polling and the media during the 2016 campaign, a series of articles coming out now on 538 called The Real Story of 2016. And E, you're on WNYC with Nate Silver. Hello, E.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Sure. Sorry, a bit nervous, but I have a question for Nate. I don't know if you're familiar with the This American Life story over the summer regarding a colleague of yours, Harry, one of your pollsters, and measuring. He was they wanted to know why how come 538 and other pollsters missed Trump's primary, was unable to predict Trump's primary win. And Harry talked about they failed to sort of like measure or understand the enthusiasm of Trump supporters versus the other candidates. And so I'm wondering, was it a situation again in the presidential for the presidential race where there was a failure by pollsters to measure, to take into consideration that there was more, perhaps more enthusiasm amongst Trump supporters than for Hillary supporters?
So, I mean, I think that might be a part of the story, but it turns out that turnout wound up being pretty high, that Clinton got about as many votes as President Obama did 4 years ago, so not record-setting turnout, but reasonably high turnout. What it looks like happened to me is that you had all these undecided voters and some third-party voters who broke toward Trump, especially in the Midwest, over the last week of the campaign. So people talk about, oh, Wisconsin, oh, Clinton, the polls were way off in Wisconsin. If you look at the polls in Wisconsin, they had Clinton at about 46% and Trump at about 42 or 43%. That wound up being Trump 48, Clinton 47. So Clinton actually did as well as her polls projected, or a point or so better. But Trump visited Wisconsin and Clinton didn't in the last weeks of the campaign. The news cycle in the last weeks of the campaign was favorable to Clinton and or unfavorable to Clinton and favorable to Trump. Trump had spoken the whole campaign to voters like the people who lived in Wisconsin, and Clinton maybe hadn't as much. And so, you know, a pollster can't do very much about voters who are undecided. But what you can do if you're modeling the election or writing about the election or reporting on the election is say, look, if both candidates are stuck in the low to mid-40s somewhere, then there's uncertainty about what this outcome would be. But, you know, again, my basic position is that the polls did in the primaries a pretty good job, actually. They kind of correctly discerned early on that Trump was popular with big parts of the Republican base. And the general election, the polls were okay, not as bad as reputed, not great either. But people, I think, and we had this mistake in the primary and learned our lesson, I think, in the general election, people came up with all sorts of clever reasons to disbelieve the poll showing that Trump could win the nomination and then the presidency. And that might reflect a sort of, you know, liberal media bias, I don't know. And again, you know, we learned this the hard way ourselves, and I think that made us more careful about saying, you know, oh, because it's easy to say, oh, look, the polls are close, but, you know, we all know Clinton's really going to win. We did not write about the general election that way. We took Trump's chances seriously because we know that we had been burned in the past by kind of filtering the data through our own bubble and ignoring polls that showed a very competitive election.
Gary in Queens, you're on WNYC. Hi, Gary.
Hi, Brian. Thanks. I thought there were several factors that confounded pollsters. Let me just list a few very quickly. I think that Trump drew from non-traditional population, some Democrats, some conservatives. Also, when you have a close election, many minor factors become major factors. And also the polling selection. Who do you poll? Do you poll representative groups or groups that tend not to answer the phone or take questions? And the final thing is there was conservative-leaning pollsters that had Trump ahead. I'm looking at the polls right now. His popularity is anywhere from 53 to 35. How could that be? You think that the mainstream was taking the more liberal pollsters for granted, and I think that's what swayed them.
Nate, where do you want to jump in there?
Well, look, first of all, the fact that, and that's right, if you look at Trump's approval ratings right now, then I see a range on Real Clear Politics anywhere from a 36% approval rating to a 55% approval rating, right? And likewise, in the polls of the popular vote, for example, you saw everything from a Trump lead of 3 points in the Los Angeles Times poll to a Clinton lead of 6 or 7 or 8 points in a couple of polls. So that alone should give you a clue that polling is not an exact science. And so, you know, again, this is why we were kind of flummoxed when it was like you have Clinton with a 2 or 3 point lead in the polling average, but you have a big spread even among good pollsters and how those numbers are determined and how they're calculated. Only about 10% of people respond to polls now, even the best polls. And so all the polls are making some inferences and some assumptions about have we really captured the electorate. So to me, that's why I kind of say, look, the polls were a couple of points off. Well, both based on history and based on kind of common sense, if you actually look at polling, is a difficult thing to do well in this day and age, then you need to build in kind of a tolerance for error. And I think that description was lacking because the media had non-polling reasons why they thought Clinton would win. They had assumptions, and they found ways to confirm those assumptions in again, polling data that didn't always show Clinton doing
well. So this is really one of your big conclusions, because I think you've said it a few ways now already, that major news organizations, people at major news organizations were reading the polls that actually showed a fairly close race with bias, not to help Hillary Clinton, but because their assumption was, oh, well, there couldn't be that many people voting for Donald Trump because he's so disqualifying of himself in so many ways. And so there was kind of an unintentional bias that made people spin it in too much of a complacent way relative to what the numbers actually were. Is that one of your main points?
That's the thesis, yeah, that you know, we think the polling actually showed and the other data showed a competitive race with Clinton favor, but a race that should have been characterized as quite uncertain, especially in the last 10 days of the campaign. One thing, too, that has occurred to me in writing this piece is that, you know, we don't have that much diversity in the media in a lot of ways, but including geographic diversity, where the way the Times and the Post and the Journal covers the race and the major networks cover the race. I mean, they have an awful lot of influence in how other journalists perceive the race and how Americans who watch the news perceive the race. And so, you know, I do wonder if you had had, like you used to have, more reporters from newspapers in Iowa and Ohio and Michigan and Wisconsin and Pennsylvania, and they had been more of a part of the conversation, whether there would have been less kind of groupthink about the outcome.
We'll continue in a minute with Nate Silver from 538 and his new series of articles, The Real Story of 2016. And when we come back, I'm going to ask Nate, with his consistent deep dive into all these numbers, if there's any way to quantify the effect of the Russian hacks and WikiLeaks publication of those John Podesta and DNC emails on the actual outcome of the race. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with Nate Silver from 538 and his new series, The Real Story of 2016. Nate, is there any way to quantify the effects of the WikiLeaks articles and or publication of the Russian hacks, all the John Podesta stuff and DNC emails? Did it tip the election?
Well, what's easier to quantify is the Comey letter on October 28th, because that was a discrete event. It happened, it upended the news cycle, and that was enough to coincide with a swing of about 3 points away from Clinton, and that's, you know, larger than the margin that she lost by in Pennsylvania and other states. You know, the WikiLeaks stuff is harder because it was drip, drip, drip. If you look at the amount of people who were looking for information about it, it was actually quite a lot. Like, Google searches for WikiLeaks was as high as it was for the FBI stories, for example. So I suspect it had some effect, and it is the case that when you have an election where, again, you had three decisive states that were within less than 100,000 votes, you know, a lot of things could have mattered, and this is possibly one of them. But because there were things coming out every day instead of just one bang event, you know, you would have to apply a more careful, I would say, methodology. So I want to be careful about you know, it's not a smoking gun the way the Comey letter is, I guess I would say.
So how close would you come to saying, from your statistical analysis, had that Comey letter not happened, that Hillary Clinton would be the president of the United States today?
I think that's probably true. And again, the easiest things to measure are a discrete event near the end of the campaign. So we know that when you have debates, for example, or conventions, and one candidate does particularly well on those, you see a shift of around 3 points, sometimes a little bit more, sometimes less after a debate. And this looked like a post-debate type shift, where you can kind of date when a poll is, and the polls taken after the Comey letter story came out showed almost in every case a decline for Clinton. And again, if this had happened, it was almost like the timing was bad for her in both ways, right? I mean, if it happened, say, in September, then the news cycle would have turned to other things, mm-hmm. and as the story was reported out. But it kind of came at the, and it sounds like a cliche, but like the worst possible time for her, right, where you had this big population of undecideds. I mean, look, the one thing you can say is that Clinton had not sealed the deal with enough voters. She was at about 45%, 46% of the vote at the time that letter hit. She wound up getting to 48%, but most of the people who hadn't decided yet went toward Trump, especially in the Midwest, where he won voters who decided in the last week by a 3-2 margin, or 2-1, I think, in Wisconsin. And so, you know, she hadn't done quite enough to seal the deal when that letter hit. At the same time, if that story hadn't happened, then it was a close election. We know that moved the polls, and so I think we probably would have had a different outcome.
And then when he came out a week later, just a couple of days before the election, and said, yeah, we looked at all this stuff, and really, I know I issued that letter, but there was nothing new there after all, so case closed again. Was it too close to the election to undo the damage?
I mean, the Clinton campaign, in comments they've made publicly, thought that might have hurt them too, because whenever people saw Clinton FBI emails in the same headlines, that they kind of had an impressionistic view that was bad. You know, I'm not sure about that. The problem is that happened so close to the end of the election that it couldn't really be measured by the polling either way. Again, you know, the one thing we know, we have lots of evidence about, is that undecided voters, late deciders, mostly broke toward Trump. And, you know, the combination of maybe her campaign not having a message. By the way, one of the things that happened, too, is that there were lots of voters, of course, who disliked both Clinton and Trump, and those voters broke strongly for Trump.
Huh.
So there are lots of things you can critique about the Clinton campaign, including, you know, they did a good job of making Trump unpopular, but they didn't mm-hmm. have a strategy to deal with voters who dislike both candidates, I don't think. And when the last recollection that voters had wasn't about the debates, where Clinton did do well, according to the polls, but you know,
Comey.
But FBI and WikiLeaks and Comey, then maybe it was natural that those voters said, you know what, I'm going to take a chance on Trump, even though I have my reservations about both candidates.
Peter in Spanish Harlem, you're on WNYC with Nate Silver. Hi, Peter.
Hey, I had a more general question about the reductionism required by the type of statistical analysis that's now become largely associated with Nate Silver. I'm not really sure how much he embraces that and how much it's just a media association. But I also generally had a comment relating to what you were just saying about how so many voters decisively seem to break for Trump, even though they had disliked both candidates leading up to that point. I know a lot of people who are generally skeptical about the idea that the government that we have as it exists, not just in terms of the president, but the actual structure of the government down to the constitutional order that it's based on, they're skeptical that it can deliver the types of like freedom and progress they want to see from this country. And they want to see like a much larger revolution than that, but they're afraid to say that out loud. And I know a lot of those people who think that Trump is a much easier person to rebel against, and who voted in the end, even though they thought both candidates were bad, and they thought Trump was really bad because of his, you know, racism and his nationalism and all this, they thought that it would be easier to resist a Trump than to resist a Clinton.
Interesting. Nate, anything on that?
I mean, look, if a candidate wins a major party nomination, then that candidate has enough support among a large enough fraction of the American public to potentially win the general election, right? And so in some ways, that's why I still think the bigger shock was Trump winning the nomination in the first place, when you had 17 candidates, by the way, instead of two. You know, in some ways, that was the bigger accomplishment, and in some ways, that was the moment when we did say, and people should have said, boy, the assumptions that journalists made about America, maybe, or at least journalists in the kind of New York bubble, you know, maybe weren't a complete rendering of how Americans really felt.
How does that pertain specifically to women, white women, who so many people in the media were shocked that Trump carried with 53%, including 45% of college-educated white women?
I mean, so what we saw is that this divide in education levels kind of transcended everything else. So not just in the white vote did you see a big split among education levels and among white women and college-educated white women, but also among the Hispanic vote, for example. You saw more of a spread based on education levels and geography, where, you know, people forget now that Clinton actually improved over Obama in a lot of cities and a lot of well-heeled suburbs and college towns and a few other places that have high education levels. But then communities in Ohio that used to be swing areas would go to Trump by 25 points, by astounding margins. And so, you know, that's partly why the polls were confusing, is that Clinton actually beat her polls and beat Obama among certain demographic groups. But, you know where they are mostly. They're in California, which doesn't help in Electoral College. They're in Texas. Clinton came much closer than Democrats have in a long time to winning Texas. Huh. Doesn't help in Electoral College. She'll only lose Texas by 7 or 8 points instead of 15, right? You know, so this coalition
seconds.
This coalition of college-educated whites plus Hispanics is really inefficiently configured. It's very coastal. It might eventually turn Arizona into a blue state. But if the Midwest goes red, that's a really hard electoral map for Democrats.
Nate Silver, the founder and editor-in-chief of ESPN's data journalism site 538, his new series, The Real Story of 2016. Thanks for sharing it with us.
Thank you, Brian.
Have a great weekend, everyone. Brian Lehrer on WNYC.